Another man's lucre. The year is 1856. The season is early September, just before spring in the southern hemisphere, too early for this voyage. Somewhere in the darkness, three other ships, our competitors, careen the waves with us. Not all of us will survive this journey. At the helm of our ship is a man, the captain, Joshua. He is 29, but his face is already weather-beaten and tired. The headaches blind him. He castigates himself now. He had misgivings before he saw this ship out of New York's harbor. He has been ill. He feels his force draining. Sometimes there's a cough, sometimes a fever. He has stood on this deck, sleepless, vigilant, for 8 days and nights, fighting the blast in the water. At the ropes and in the rigging, far above the twisting sea, are his crew. Men and boys, barefoot on icy decks too slick for shoe leather. They too are frightened, tired. One among them, shackled in chains below these decks, is angry, vengeful. There is a woman, too, the sole female inhabitant of this bark. She is small and plump, and her black plaited hair cannot be contained in this tempest. She's a sea captain's wife, and just 19, Marianne. Her wide skirts and oilskin cloak, her only defense against a polar wind, disguise for the moment the warm, gentle swell in her belly. She wants desperately for them to win this race. The prize means for her and Joshua freedom. With this purse, with the sale of this cargo, destined to fuel a gold rush making more men rich in distant California, there will be enough. Enough to imagine a different future for them and their baby. Enough to buy a share of a ship and chart one's own course. Enough, they said to each other when they dreamed, to build a little farm on their land in Maine, where the Weskig River meets the sea and the salt marshes stretch beyond for many acres. But first, they must survive. For 8 days and nights, Joshua has stood on the quarterdeck and fought the sea. In the gray half-light of the ninth morning, there is no fight left in him. He slips to the deck and lets the darkness take him. There is a cry from somewhere among the crew, "Captain!" In the shadows below the deck, the angry, vengeful officer waits, indignation swelling, also expectant. His eyes narrow. Marianne understands. There will be no safe harbor in San Francisco, no freedom, no farm running down to the banks of the Weskig River, unless she fights for them. This is the moment her story begins. Chapter 1. Penobscot Bay. This was that earth of which we have heard, made out of chaos and old night. Here was no man's garden, but the unhand-celled globe. Thoreau, The Maine Woods. But before the story of the sea, there was the story of the land. As difficult as it may be, at the distance of nearly two centuries, to imagine a tempest at sea on a clipper ship at the bottom of the world, it is almost as difficult now to remember a time when the coast of Maine was at the center of a deeply connected and prosperous international culture. The global trade and quiet affluence that flowed along its shores stretched in a current of wealth that ran from New York and Boston northward, down east, as we say, all the way to Nova Scotia. All along the seacoast, there were ports. Behind the ports, there were farms. And in the fields of the farms, there were winding stone walls. Today, drive along the roads of Maine and look into the woods. The old stone walls now meander through forest that was once, not so long ago, open pasture. It was the sea that made this area rich and populous, the sea that connected it to the world beyond, to places like San Francisco and London, Liverpool, and Buenos Aires. It was the sea captains, those soldiers of fortune, who carried around the world and brought home